Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Smith, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for November 17. This is the first of our three oral matters on our calendar today. The file number is A210428, Craig Sherber and Associates, Inc. is the respondent, Matt Bullock Contracting Company, Inc. is appellant. And counsel, you should see the clock in the corner of your screen. And so once you begin speaking, of course, that will, in its usual manner, begin running. So appellant will have 15 minutes of the same for respondent, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal if appellant so chooses. We do ask that you identify yourself for our record at the beginning of your comments. And if for some reason we lose connection with you, we will pause the clock and attempt to restart. Any recording is separately prohibited by judicial branch rules, but we will have the recording available on our website within 24 hours. With that said, then, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Justice Lindell, counsel for appellant Matt Bullock Contracting Company, Inc. Your Honors, this case presents a straightforward legal question as to whether the availability of statutory mechanics lien rights extinguishes a contractor's rights in equity. Essentially, whether the enactment of Section 514.01, which establishes a mechanics lien for persons improving real property, actually did away with the contractor's common law right to bring an action in equity, unjust enrichment, or quantum merit. The appellant believes that the statute did not dispose of these common law remedies and therefore respectfully seeks reversal of the district court's ruling. In this case, Your Honors, appellant performed some dirt work to improve the lots on the subject real property. The work was done in 2015. The labor for which appellant remains unpaid was valued at $127,151. In 2020, appellant recorded a mechanics lien on the property for these outstanding amounts. Shortly after that, the respondent purchased the lots from the developer, knowing about the appellant's work that had not been paid for, and sued appellant for slander of title due to the defects in the mechanics lien. And the appellant then released the lien. Once the complaint was served, the appellant released the lien. And importantly, it's undisputed here that the appellant's mechanics lien was not valid because it had been filed more than 120 days after the appellant's last day of work on the property.
Mr. Lindell, can I ask you, I'm a little unclear. You use the phrase extinguish, and in your briefing as well, it seems to me there's no dispute, I assume, from your client that the mechanics lien is a legal remedy. And secondly, no dispute that the overarching maxim that equity follows the law still exists. And Southtown, of course, confirmed that. And the case that you cited, the Karen case from 1935, nowhere in there do we know that they discussed that issue or raised that issue. I understand why you cited it, because it's certainly the factual result, end result, but nowhere is that mentioned. And in fact, telling to me is in the Southtown case, they made reference to the case from 1932. I can't recall now exactly the name of the case, but I believe it was Kingery, which also cited the overriding precept that equity follows the law. And so clearly here, as the judge pointed out, it was undisputed that your client had a mechanics lien option, factually not only chose not to do it, but apparently falsified work post the 120 days, in other words, demonstrate an affirmative decision not to file the mechanics lien. What I'm not sure I understand is how, as a matter of law, did the court get wrong the fact that there was a remedy that your client chose, just like in Southtown, not to utilize?
So, I mean, I think that's really what's at the heart of this case, Your Honor. I certainly agree. Your questions get right to what we're talking about. there's an enormous difference between the facts of Southtown, which, and I have no problem with Southtown. In that case, they had timely recorded a mechanics lien. So they had their adequate remedy at law. They made a conscious decision not to foreclose on it and instead to attempt to move forward with an equitable claim. So they had their perfected mechanics lien. They could easily have moved forward with foreclosing upon it. But
what I'm getting at, though, is that seems like a difference without distinction. Your client consciously chose not to file a lien. And if you look in Southtown, I guess what my question more is the overriding maxim that equity follows the law. The point being is that it seems that the focus in Southtown and the court made the point that the reason for that maxim is that when there's a legislative, in this case, directive for contractors to utilize, it would be contrary to that legislative directive, that legal remedy available, to simply ignore it and be able to pursue an equitable remedy. That seems contrary to the maxim that we're talking about, and Southtown simply confirmed it. So I'm not sure I follow why that maxim would not apply to your client in this case, as the judge concluded.
Well, I think that's the huge distinction, though, Your Honor, is the way that the judge set this up. The trial court's decision in this case means that no contractor has equitable rights at all, period, anymore under Minnesota law. Because if they make a mistake, and I think that's an important, you were talking about a distinction without a difference, and I respectfully disagree, because any person who does not timely file a lien made a decision, right? Whether inadvertently or not, they had the opportunity to timely record their lien and they didn't do it. So they made a decision, or they acted or failed to act. You know, they made a decision not to look up the statute and see what the timeline was, or they made a decision not to call their lawyer and get good advice, or what have you. Every person that fails to timely file a lien is responsible for their own decision-making that led to that eventuality. However, under the district court's ruling, any person that fails to timely file their lien has no equitable remedy.
So, and would that not be legally the correct result, though? No, to say it another way, and I'm thinking other than the Karen case, because they didn't address this issue we're talking about here. Is there any law that you have cited to us or could cite to us that would indicate that the maxim does not apply in mechanics lien cases?
Well, I think that the maxim is distinguishable and not applicable here, because the way that the district court applied that maxim was to decide that because mechanics lien rights exist under the statute, you cannot assert equitable claims, which is stating that the enactment of the mechanics lien statute abrogated common law rights of equity. And under Minnesota law, and this is the Seward case that's cited in our brief, 793 Northwest 2nd, 272, Minnesota Supreme Court, 2011, courts presume that the legislature does not intend to abrogate the common law unless it does so by express wording or necessary implication in the language of the statute. And the mechanics lien statute, section 514.13, states that it makes clear that common law claims are not being abrogated by its enactment, because it says the rights granted by this chapter are non-exclusive.
Mr. Lindell, and I didn't see that language in the judge's order that it was abrogating the common law option of unjust enrichment. I did see that it was simply ruling that in this case, because there was an adequate remedy at law that was chosen not to be utilized, that following the maxim in this case, it was not available. And so I think, and you point this out, it's fairly common in mechanics lien actions or foreclosure to plead in the alternative unjust enrichment. And I didn't see anything from this court's order that would abrogate that option in most cases.
I respectfully disagree, Judge. Under the district court's order, what he said was, because the mechanics lien statute existed, you know, this client didn't timely perfect his lien. The district court said the existence of the mechanics lien statute means you had an adequate remedy at law. Therefore, you have no equitable remedies. That ruling means that no contractor can ever bring an equitable claim for unjust enrichment or quantum merit, because all you have to do is point back at the district court's ruling and say, look, they only have mechanics lien rights or breach of contract rights, and that's it. They have no equitable rights, because the statute, the mere existence of the statute, means that they have an adequate remedy in law and therefore no equitable remedies. And what that brings us to, Judge, the impact of the district court's order is that he's saying the existence of the mechanics lien statutory right got it did away with it abrogated the availability of an equitable claim.
Can I ask
there
counsel,
isn't a circumstance?
Counsel, may I ask? And I assume two questions, I guess. So I understand your argument about the mechanics lien. Does it matter that there was a potential breach of contract claim against the developer? I assume you're going to say no because they're different parties. Why isn't that another legal remedy?
So that would be a legal remedy against the developer. But the issue is, this was an unjust enrichment claim against a follow-on purchaser who had took possession of these valuable improvements without paying for them, knowing that they hadn't been paid for, and then turned around and sold the lots, which had been improved, right? So they were made marketable. They were made saleable by my client's efforts, which had not been paid for. And the respondent benefited from that unpaid for work by buying the lots and then turning around and reselling them. So he was unjustly enriched. So that claim, there is no legal claim against the respondent, because there was never a contract between Bullock and Sherber.
And secondly, thank you. Secondly, I understand your argument about Karen and how you analogize it here. Is there any other, what are your best cases besides Karen that recognize, I don't know if there are any cases precisely like this where you have a follow-on owner, I mean, where the financer becomes the owner, but what's the best case that you have besides Karen that would recognize an unjust enrichment claim in these circumstances?
So you have, there's a couple of unpublished appellate court cases that are cited in our brief where you had the availability of equitable claims that were allowed to proceed. But they're not fantastic, because they're not perfectly on point in terms of the background facts. But there are a couple of unpublished Minnesota Court of Appeals cases cited in our brief where you had mechanics lien claims and unjust enrichment or other equitable claims that were allowed to proceed, which we argued demonstrated that the availability of the mechanics lien rights, if you fail to perfect your lien, you can still have an unjust enrichment claim under Minnesota law. And that's why contractors always, you foreclose your lien and they always assert unjust enrichment and breach of contract. Because it may be that you had, for example, a change order that didn't comply with contractual provisions or what have you, but the customer absolutely wanted, an additional 100 feet of driveway poured. So you did the work, you should get paid for it, but it's not a breach of contract claim because maybe you didn't do a change order like the contract said. And if you didn't timely file your lien, or if there was a problem with pre-lien notice or something else, meaning that your lien wasn't perfected, well, you should still get paid for that work. If you poured, 100 extra feet of driveway and concrete and the guy likes it and is driving on it, you should get paid for that. But under the district court's ruling, only if your mechanics lien is valid do you have any relief. If you mess that up, you're done. There's no equitable claim, because you could have, under the district court's ruling, you could have timely filed a lien that complied with the statutory requisites. And under the district court's ruling, that is your only available remedy if you don't have a contract in place. If you mess
did
up-
Did you argue, thank you. And I should know this, and I apologize that I don't, but I understand your argument is that the district court's reasoning would foreclose an unjust enrichment claim, even against that owner who knows it, right? And here we have a follow-on owner who is not involved at the time, right, of the improvements, et cetera. Did you argue, were the merits of the unjust enrichment claim in no circumstances argued to the district court, but then not addressed in the ruling?
So we sought summary judgment on our unjust enrichment claim, walking through the elements and showing that the respondent had received a benefit, you know, had been unjustly enriched, had received a benefit that was unpaid for under circumstances which made that compensable on behalf of the appellant. Obviously, the respondent disagreed, but the court did not rule on the merits of whether these circumstances constituted unjust enrichment. Instead, simply deciding, hey, you could have timely filed a lien and you didn't, and that means that you cannot have equitable relief. And so at the end of the day, the merits of the unjust enrichment claim are to be determined. But our main point here is that the district court's ruling means that the mechanics lien statute effectively abrogated all equitable rights for contractors, which is not supported by Minnesota law. Minnesota Supreme Court's never indicated that. And the statute itself indicates that it's not intended to abrogate the common law. Therefore, we feel that the district court's ruling should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that's my time.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, if you would please identify yourself and you may begin. Mr. Miller, you remain muted.
John Miller, on behalf of the respondent in this matter, may it please the court, I plan to, in my comments here, go over a couple of the issues which we raised in our main brief. Then I'm going to try to keep as much time available for any responses or other discussions regarding the appellate's position that was primarily discussed in the his presentation, particularly the issue regarding the effect of the perfection. In our brief, we raised the issue regarding some wording in the court's order concerning the value of the work that was done. In the order, it stated that the value of the work was $127,151, and the cite to that is a cite to the deposition, which stated that that is the amount that was owed.
Counsel, can I begin actually with there? I understand what you're saying about that. I'm not sure, you know, what our role is vis-a-vis that issue, but that issue raises something for me. I think your argument, as I understand it, is the measure of damages for an unjust enrichment claim are not the cost paid, or that they're not the cost of the improvements, but the cost of the the increase in value, and that there was a conflation of those two. I think that's what you're talking about, how one would measure the what's available in an unjust enrichment claim. What that raises for me is, assuming that unjust enrichment, that the damages that would be available are not necessarily equal to the cost of the improvements, then doesn't that tell us that those are different claims? In other words, wouldn't that tend to suggest that a mechanics lien doesn't foreclose an unjust enrichment claim because you're actually seeking something else, not just payment on the contract that was due to the contractor for which the lien would represent, but you're seeking the increase in value. If there's no increase in value, it would be zero, even if there was an unpaid bill. So I guess when we look at Karen, you know, Karen was a lien was disallowed because it was untimely, but the owner was still on the hook for the unjust enrichment because they did improvements to his farm where his brother was living. I guess what, besides sort of the factual difference that this is a follow-on owner, which might be important for the unjust enrichment claim, I'm not exactly sure why the reasoning of the district court is right here. In light of Karen, if Karen is good law.
Okay. Your Honor, our position with respect to this particular issue is not that there was a finding of fact by the district court with respect to the issue of damages. And what we wanted to do is point out that there's no reference in the court order to damages. And then in the reply brief, I listed about five or six other facts or situations or arguments in favor of our position that there was no determination of damages, that was only meant to reflect the actual cost of the improvements.
Right, exactly. Okay, so if we get to my question about why the mechanics lien under, do you only win if Karen is not good law? I mean, you suggested that Karen is old and maybe not so good anymore. But I'm wondering if Karen is good law, why is the district court's reasoning correct that the availability of a mechanics lien forecloses an unjust enrichment claim?
There's a certain sense in which the I think I understand your question, and it may be moving into the issue that is the principal issue that you discussed earlier. And our position is that basically the I think what we have to all keep in mind is that contractors have this very special statutory remedy in order to get paid. It's a remedy that's not available to many other people that are engaged in contracts. And what it does is it allows them to essentially find a source for the collection of the amount that's done by going through very specific detail, the requirements of the mechanics lien statute. And I believe that the court's order does actually reflect that with respect to the finding that the mechanics lien statute is available remedy at law.
Does that reasoning comport with Karen and how?
I don't think that it does comport with Karen, but the thing that we have to keep in mind with respect to Karen is it does not have any reference to the issue of the availability of remedy at law. It completely ignored that defense. And not only did it ignore that defense, it ignored the defense that it didn't ignore the defense. It ignored the element in an unjust enrichment case that the acts of the targeted party, in this case, the defendant, the defendant, wasn't unjust. And by that, I mean that the element of an unjust enrichment case has to be a finding that the party allegedly benefited, did something immoral or illegal, those types of things. And it has ignored that, and that has been brought out at least in one other case that cited Karen. And the other reason that we have to be a little bit apprehensive about Karen, and this is close to the fact that it didn't address the available remedy at law, it's also in the subsequent cases that have cited Karen, at least the ones that I was able to find, actually showed that that was a case that was really based on whether or not there was a enforceable contract at law, and whether or not there was a contract by agency, and the court said that there wasn't, so then it went to the quasi-contract analysis.
Miller, can I follow up Judge Smith's question?
Sure.
Just a little bit of different scenario. Let's assume hypothetically that Bullock had perfected their mechanics lien. Okay. And, but also alleged, as they do in their action to foreclose, unjust enrichment. I assume your position is that they would still have a valid unjust enrichment claim as part of their foreclosure of the mechanics lien if they could demonstrate damages in excess. In other words, the value to your client, let's say, is $150,000, though the work is $127,000. So the foreclosure value is $127,000, but they may have an unjust enrichment claim against your client in excess of that. Would you agree with that proposition?
No, I wouldn't, Your Honor.
And on what basis?
Because the mechanics lien statute enforces a contract at law. And there's, I am not aware of any case or any rationale which would allow the mechanics lien recovery to be based on anything other than what is owed to the contract amount.
That's why I asked, though, the separate remedy of unjust enrichment. Are you indicating that that precludes that? As Mr. Lindell points out, in all actions typically, or I don't know if it's all, but it's fairly common that an alternative pleading with the mechanics lien includes unjust enrichment. Are you indicating that that's an exclusive remedy?
Well, with respect to the concurrent bringing of actions regarding unjust enrichment and statutory claims, I cited a couple of cases in the brief, and the name of one of them is Schimmel. I can't remember the, it's a tough one to pronounce. Then there's another federal case that points out that you can have alternative pleading. The federal case points that out. And it probably would be possible to bring a mechanics lien action and then bring a separate mechanic or separate action for unjust enrichment, especially if there were questions about the validity of the mechanics lien action.
The reason I'm asking is I'm getting to the your response to Mr. Lindell is that his belief that the district court abrogated unjust enrichment. Now, we have unique facts here, so you don't have a contract with your client and Bullock. But nevertheless, if a lien had been filed, but it was inadequate, meaning the $127,000, the inadequacy would be the difference between that and whatever value above that. Is there any law that would preclude additional damages under an unjust enrichment action as part of the pleading?
As part of the pleading, no, but I don't think that you could ever get a recovery on an unjust enrichment claim as part of the foreclosure in a mechanics lien case. I believe that...
Doesn't the district court's action or decision in this case foreclose an unjust enrichment claim? I mean, on the basis of the existence of the mechanics liens rights.
Yes, I believe that's exactly what the court has ruled in that case, and it's consistent with law.
And I think you rely on this Southtown case. And I was kind of looking at that case and struggling a little bit with it because, you use it for the principle that the availability of a mechanics lien rights would foreclose an unjust enrichment claim. But in that case, the court says that, and it goes on to evaluate two cases, Anderson and Twin City, two other cases where they say, oh yes, well, appellant argues this, those cases are different because there was sort of immoral conduct, et cetera, it seems like. In other words, mm-hmm. It went to the unjust enrichment merits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand how those two things fit together. I mean, you wouldn't get to the merits if the mechanics lien statute just basically forecloses getting to the merits of unjust enrichment. I'm trying to understand that case. And if that case goes to the merits of the unjust enrichment claim, shouldn't similarly the merits of the unjust enrichment claim be at issue in this case?
I think that, as I recall in Southtown, that was a response to a question. And I don't think that there's anything the Anderson case in Anderson versus Delisle may have been Schumacher because that's a similar case. I can't remember what it was. Those were the discussion on those was not necessary in Southtown. And it was, like I said, a response to a question by the defendant in that case. But Southtown completely foreclosed the issue of any equitable relief by its holding, which I believe was the correct holding and still valid today.
So even if a party, we'll just posit for purposes of argument that a person is unjustly enriched, whether it be the owner, subsequent owner, financer, whatever, that party is unjustly enriched, could in fact prove its claim on the merits. You're saying that in all of those cases, the mechanics lien right forecloses a claim. I mean,
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I have a few more comments, but I'd just like to...
Mr. Miller, before you get into that, I did want to ask you one question about the slander of title. There was much discussion during the hearing with the judge about that issue, and it seemed like everybody was focusing on attorney's fees as the damages during the oral discussion. And yet, and in fact, the argument I think Mr. Lindell had made, or I don't know if it was him or his client at the hearing, that there was no way of proving a connection of clearing the title to the fees that were incurred. But the judge made no mention of that other than to simply say they could not be, there is no, I can't remember the exact phrase, but basically it was not possible to prove them. And hence that element was missing. On what basis did the judge make that determination in this Rule 12 proceeding? In other words, what was missing in the record or in the allegation that the judge overlooked for Rule 12 dismissal purposes? And I know your time's run out, but I feel free to answer the question, please.
Okay. Just real quickly, from a Rule 12 perspective, we pled that there were special damages that could be proved at the time of the trial. I believe that the judge ignored that, and for some reason or another, and I'm not entirely certain why, he just completely disregarded or missed the fact that attorney's fees to eliminate the cloud on title are recoverable. I have no explanation of why that was, because it was thoroughly briefed, and the appellant down below, and I think even at the appellate level, indicates that attorney's fees to eliminate the cloud on title are damages that can be awarded in a slander of title action.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Miller. I appreciate that. And Mr. Lindell, you will have 5 minutes, although I'm just going to take the opportunity to ask you to follow up on that, because you make the argument that in your brief that there's no way, or they lack the ability to connect the fees to the clearing of the title. But why would they have to do that for Rule 12 purposes if they've alleged special damages? Isn't that not sufficient to withstand Rule 12 dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there was essentially a drafting mistake or something overlooked by the district court in connection with those arguments. These were cross motions for summary judgment. So we went in on undisputed facts, et cetera, under Rule 56 motion. And our argument on the attorney's fees was that the undisputed facts of record showed that Bullock was not aware that the property had changed ownership, and that if he had been aware that that Sherber was going to bring a complaint for slander of title, he would have just released the lien. Bullock put in an affidavit explaining that. And at the time, right after we got the complaint, Bullock released the lien because his issue with the lien was with the developer of the property.
Just to clarify, Mr. Lindell, though, aren't we bound? The court very clearly considered it as Rule 12. Isn't that our basis of review and our sole basis of review, whether any error occurred on either motion based solely on the Rule 12 analysis and not summary judgment?
Honestly, Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, because we presented these on a Rule 56 basis. Both parties did. It was never briefed as Rule 12. So I don't know if that provides daylight for the court to look at it from a Rule 12 or Rule 56.
Well, I appreciate your honesty in the answer. Certainly.
I mean, no disrespect to the trial court judge. I know that he was, relatively recently appointed, and I think sometimes you see some drafting issues when this stuff gets put in. But I certainly understand under Rule 12 motion, I'm not arguing that they failed to plead special damages. That was in the complaint, and I agree with Mr. Miller on that point. They did plead special damages of attorney's fees, so I'm not arguing that wasn't part of the complaint. So I want to be clear about that.
I did. Lindell, may I ask? Can you talk more about Southtown here? Because yes. You know, there's a paragraph that talks about, you know, when there's a remedy through mechanics lien, actually, you know, that a mechanics lien statute limits bars recovery on the basis of unjust enrichment. And there's a string cite of cases for that. I know that you distinguish Southtown because there they timely filed but then didn't pursue. Let's assume for purposes of my question that that's a distinction that doesn't matter with respect to choosing not to file versus, you know, not pursuing it. Why doesn't Southtown govern here? Is that the only difference?
I think that Southtown, I think that is the distinguishing point, that Southtown is, it's very important. Southtown is different from other cases because you had a situation where they had perfected their lien. They had their lien rights to foreclose on, and they relinquished them. They waived them. And the court said, look, you have an available remedy at law. And that's absolutely clear. And I think that is a huge difference between that and other cases. When you have a perfected mechanics lien and you just decide that you're not going to foreclose upon it, that's very different than if you made a mistake in, you know, recording, or if you made a mistake, you sent the pre-lien notice to the wrong person or what have you. I don't think that Southtown anywhere says the existence of the mechanics lien statute is that's the only remedy you have. It's that or breach of contract. We're getting rid of equitable remedies. And if you mess up your lien, you better have a contract because you do not have an equitable remedy.
Lindell, how does that differ? You use the phrase a mistake. What I'm trying to understand is here, yeah, there's a conscious decision not to, is all we know. They just decided not to file and perfect. Is there any law that you can point us to that would indicate that basis for failing to pursue the mechanics lien somehow differs from the Southtown ruling?
Well, I can't point to a case where the judges looked at sort of the contractor's motivations, but I think I think that's the important distinguishing factor. It's not the motivation, it is the timing.
So let me just ask it another way. Is your understanding of the proposition being, and we should so note in our order, that contractors, for whatever reason, decide not to pursue a mechanics lien, still have a unjust enrichment claim in mechanics lien, in otherwise mechanics lien actions?
No, what I think Southtown stands for, and what I think Minnesota law supports, is that if you mess up your mechanics liens rights, you know, in this case, the contractor was on the phone, he was talking to the developer, who said, you know, hey, just, you know, come by and shovel a sidewalk, send me an invoice, do something, but you're going to mess up my deal with the bank. Please don't file yet. We'll keep the lien alive. And my client went along with it. It's not at all clear that he understood that it wouldn't be valid, you know, at the time that those things were happening, you know, but he didn't perfect on time. I think Southtown stands for the proposition that when you are holding a perfected mechanics lien in your hand, you have timely filed, you have obeyed the pre-lien notice requirements, and et cetera. You have 1 year to commence your foreclosure action. You've got a valid lien. If you're holding that in your hand and you decide to instead attempt to pursue equitable rights, those are barred under the straightforward maxim. You've got an available legal remedy. And here, and in any case where a contractor makes a mistake, is too slow, there's no difference. A mistake is a choice. You know, it's all human activity. Somebody who fails to get it to the mailbox on time, decided to take that phone call from a client, or they decided to stop and fill up their car with gas. Not getting it timely filed is always a choice on the part of the contractor. And I think that this is a huge change in Minnesota law, where under this district court's ruling, if you mess up and you don't timely file your lien, you're done. You have no equitable remedies, which is reading the statute to say that equitable remedies are abrogated, which is contrary to Minnesota law because the statute doesn't say that. And it's contrary to Minnesota law because the statute actually says that it's not intended to displace the common law. That's really where I come in on it, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel. We appreciate your discussion with us today regarding the Southtown and Karen cases, mechanics liens, and unjust enrichment. It's been an enjoyable experience in that sense. Thank you for your briefing as well. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days, and you each have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks to everyone on the panel.